Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. You're tuned into the Geneva Business Insider for the month of December 2014. And as always, we're joined by our lovely and talented co-host, David L. Smith of the Geneva Business Insider blog, GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. But not as always, he is not joining us from Geneva today. He's out and about on a business trip at the moment. So may whatever gods you believe in honorably favor the hotel Wi-Fi enabled Skype connection that we're talking through today, but it seems to be all right at the moment, and I'm glad about that. David L. Smith, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Maybe I should be reserving the domain name CaymanBusinessInsider.com. We'll see.
There you go. Sounds suitably shady. I mean, no, I'm just kidding. All right. Well, okay, let's get straight into today's news. As always, we have so much to talk about, but this month in particular, I saw a number of different gold-related stories that I wanted to get your take on, starting obviously with the Save Our Swiss Gold referendum results that just came in at the end of last month. And for those of you living under a rock, yes, the Swiss overwhelmingly voted against this initiative, which would have mandated a 20% gold reserve for the Swiss franc. And it wasn't even close, 78% voting against something that, as Zero Hedge notes, even the Associated Press termed this protecting the country's wealth by investing in gold. But apparently the Swiss weren't interested in that. Kind of strange for such a gold-crazy country in many ways. But anyway, of course, why would you listen to me babble on about this result when we have an actual Swiss resident? David L. Smith, your take on what actually happened there with that referendum?
I think, first of all, I'm disappointed with the result because, as we all know, the way the system works is that central banks control more or less what goes on, and the mechanism for doing that is being able to create debt, being able to manipulate interest rates, being able to manipulate liquidity. And, of course, they would not want to give any of these things up. Now, the Swiss population are, generally very, very good at, going out and voting for things that they believe in. I mean, even on rainy Sunday or snowing Sunday afternoons, they will turn out in pretty large numbers to express their democratic views. So when we see a result like this, one has to say, why? To me, in the last few weeks leading up to the vote, There was an enormous amount of effort made by the Swiss establishment and the central banks to make sure that the public was indoctrinated with the idea that all these things were bad for the Swiss economy. It would create strictures on what the central banks could do, which you and I would think was exactly the desired purpose. But for people who are not particularly too well informed about it, they read and listen to all this and think, oh well, maybe that's bad for the country. The Swiss National Bank Act, I've forgotten the name of it just for the instant, but it basically starts off by saying that the Swiss National Bank should always act extremely clear that that is not what has happened. From day one, when you start going down to zero interest rates, you are prejudicing savers. You're favoring, people who are on the speculative side of markets by providing them with low interest rate money. You're favoring a real estate bubble, which is the Swiss Central Bank is seriously concerned in. And you're also allowing the situation where there's a vast amount of money that has been printed in order to buy euros and sell Swiss francs to weaken the currency. So it means that the savers are penalized two times over by the central bank's manipulation, by weakening deliberately the exchange rate and providing them with no income on their capital. So this is a disgrace which people happily brush under the table and ignore. The other aspect of it, of course, is that the people who are members of the board of the Swiss National Bank and who propagate these stories are the usual suspects. They're all kind of economists from the big universities in Switzerland who are all sitting in more or less tenured positions and appointed to these boards as they are to several others. And Switzerland is run by a very small mafia of families and a very small mafia of more kind of business and economic elites than you'd say political elites, because the politicians are just pretty much of a joke. So all of these things combined create a situation where the average Swiss, who actually still very much believes what he hears on television, because by and large, on most subjects, things are relatively truthful. So when the big lie comes along, they don't really realize what it is, and they go along with the party line, and they say, well, the head of the central bank must be right, the minister of economics must be right, the board members of the central banks must be right, the other investors in the central bank, who include all of the main cantonal banks who have representation on the board, you know, these are the local heroes, if you like, of the financial establishment, it must all be right. So there's an acquiescence in something where most people regard it as being above their level of knowledge to actually question what they're being served up with as a prepackaged, let's call it fact in inverted commas, and hence the vote failed. A few months ago, I was very much in favor. I thought the vote would be much closer, but, you know, there you are. That's democracy, and democracy, like justice, sometimes can be blind.
It certainly can be, and especially, as you say, when the entire establishment throws its weight behind one side or the other right before the election takes place, as we saw with the Scottish referendum that we covered last time. But let's talk about some of the implications of this. As I understand that, and I'm not at all clear on this, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but the Swiss franc is on an effective euro peg, where the Swiss National Bank has decided to maintain a minimum exchange rate of 1.2 francs to the euro. I assume if this had passed, it would have been very difficult for the SNB to maintain that peg because of the gold reserves that it would have had to have accumulated in order to maintain that. So I'm assuming that this is favorable to the establishment, which of course always wants its ability to basically print as much money as it wants. Are there any other sort of ramifications for this vote with Swiss EU relations?
No, I would have thought once again what has happened is the Swiss National Bank has played the party line of the other central banks, but what it does do is it points once again to the fact that there are parallel forces which are running our pseudo democracies, and you know, you start at the top of the pile with the Bank of International Settlements, which is in Switzerland as well. Then you have all the other central banks. They all work in very effective coordination, whereas the politicians are in disastrous lack of coordination. And the people who are sitting in the Swiss National Bank and others, whether you like them or not, are usually pretty smart, whereas our politicians are, generally speaking, slimy dummies who follow the guidance that they're given and whoever they think is going to help them get re-elected. So with those, you know, an uncoordinated team of losers against a well-coordinated team of well-financed winners, you know how the game ends up. So I think that's about where I see it at the moment.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that assessment in the least, and as unfortunate as it may be, anyone who thinks that the politicians are actually running their country and not the bankers that support them in the background, I think needs their head re-examined. On that note, as you say, the central banks make some important decisions and sometimes some surprising decisions. And one that we're going to highlight next is one that I think took myself and I think most of the people that I was around at the time in the Netherlands by surprise, which was the Dutch central bank's sudden surprise announcement near the end of November that they were repatriating 122 tons of sovereign gold reserves from New York to Amsterdam, which raises the amount of the Dutch central bank's gold holdings in Amsterdam to 31% of its reserves, up from 20%. Up from 11%. So they have significantly repatriated a large amount of gold from New York. And again, I didn't have any inkling this was even underway. I didn't know this process was happening. None of the people I was talking to in the Netherlands knew this was happening either. It was just sort of a surprise announcement. What does this portend? Where did this come from? Why is this happening? Is this part of the general repatriation trend we've been seeing taking shape in the last few years?
Well, I'm not sure we've had a repatriation trend. I mean, we have a non-repatriation trend, I think. It's probably more exact, with the possible exception of Venezuela, who actually today seem to need all the gold that they have possibly have and more besides. But that was at the time of Chavez. He repatriated the gold, much to the objection of the Americans. I don't know. I have no insights whatsoever into this. All I can say is congratulations for the Dutch, because they're actually showing intelligence. They're kind of the continental European Scotsman, so I have to be slightly prejudiced and say well done for them. Is there anything underlying it apart from that? I honestly don't know. I could only speculate, and I don't think it'd be fair to waste people's time with that.
Well, I agree that there has been this non-repatriation trend, as you put it, certainly when it comes to the German case. And we've seen, for example, in France, there are certain political parties that are agitating for some repatriation and things like this. So I see it as part of a trend that apparently kicked off in 2011 when Venezuela repatriated some of its gold. And I am very much looking forward to seeing the next domino to fall, because one gets the feeling that there is something taking place. And for myself, that feeling is further bolstered by articles like this one, which I found on gold-eagle.com, Grandmaster Putin's Golden Trap, which reads, "Very few people understand what Putin is doing at the moment, and almost no one understands what he will do in the future. No matter how strange it may seem, but right now, Putin is selling Russian oil and gas only for physical gold. Putin is not shouting about it all over the world, and of course he still accepts US dollars as an intermediate means of payment, but he immediately exchanges all these dollars obtained from the sale of oil and gas for physical gold." And then this article goes on to break down the amount of gold purchases that have been undertaken by central banks around the globe in the third quarter of 2014, marking the 15th consecutive quarter of net purchases of gold by central banks. I think a significant development in and of itself. And in this last quarter, third quarter 2014, the central banks of the world bought a combined total of 93 tons of gold, 55 tons of which was Russia, so more than all of the other central banks in the world combined. I think that's obviously just one quarter's worth of data and needs to be seen in a greater context, but certainly does paint a picture of what we've seen in recent years with both Russia and China adding rather furiously to their gold holdings. Is this just more of the same? Is this a significant move? Is this part of a trend? Does this have anything to do with why countries are so interested in repatriating their gold these days?
Well, I think... You know, Putin is, you know, the fact that he is buying gold in 55 tons a quarter, a couple of hundred tons a year, is, I think, a very positive thing for gold. I mean, the prices at the moment have been driven down by manipulation for a long time. But if you look at, for example, China, between the gold production that they have and their imports, if I remember correctly, they're over 1,000 tons. And in terms also of petroleum exports, gas and oil exports from Russia, these amount to several hundred billion a year, again from memory. But you know, a couple of billion dollars worth of gold, which is probably what 550 tons is worth, is significant in the sense of the fact it's being done, but it's not material in terms of the overall situation. I mean, if Putin really wanted to put the cat among the pigeons in the gold market, all he should do is buy in the futures market and ask for delivery of a large amount of gold and start selling the U.S. treasuries that he's probably still stuck with, and then the game would change. But that's not a game of one or two billion. That's a game of tens or hundreds of billions, and that would I would very much enjoy watching that happen.
I see what you mean there. I understand that urge, because one does want to see some sort of breaking point reached in this system that we know has been stretched to the point of all absurdity. And yet when those breaking points happen, there are a lot of people who get left by the wayside and a lot of innocent people who get crushed under the wheels of this giant machinery that's been placed over them. So I'm somewhat worried about that possibility as well, which of course brings us to the question of, you know, how people protect themselves in this environment. But interestingly, you mentioned the gold price, and the gold price... I don't know what people were expecting to happen after the Swiss gold referendum, but it probably was not what actually happened. We saw a brief dip in gold prices at the time of the referendum, but actually then it started to spike, and then it held around 1,200. Now it's back up to 1,240, where it was a few months ago. So we saw this incredible dip in the gold prices from up almost 1,250 in the late October down to 1,140 by early November, and now back up to around 1,240. Quite a big dip and rise in gold. Is this related to any particular cyclical moves, any market forces? Is this all manipulation? Does this have to do with the gold referendum? Does this have to do with repatriation? Is it a combination of these factors? What's the dominant force driving this this current spike and rise?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that just preceding the Swiss gold election, the voting, not election, the prices dropped significantly. And I put this down to manipulation. I mean, the price of commodities is manipulated on a daily basis. You know, oil, gold, it doesn't matter what you name. There's nothing in the system that is not manipulated. So I don't put all that much store by this. I mean, I don't have huge insights into day-to-day trading, but it's very obvious that the trends that take place are contradictory to what should be normally happening in the marketplace. And, perhaps we talked about gold. You perhaps want to touch on the Ukraine and Libya at the same time.
Let's do that. And I have a story here from Zero Hedge. Ukraine admits its gold is gone. There is almost no gold left in the central bank vault. So this is a story that relates to a story that I believe we've touched on. I know I've covered here on the Corbett Report, which was this idea that has been floated around. There was some unconfirmed reports that the Ukrainian gold was basically flown out of the country in a secret nighttime flight around the time of the new coup-installed government taking over. And there was a lot of speculation at the time that basically this was the price of Ukraine's liberation was handing over the gold to the Fed. Of course, that was all speculation at the time, perhaps informed speculation. But interestingly enough, the head of the Ukrainian Central Bank on national Ukrainian TV just admitted that in the vaults of the central bank, there is almost no gold left. There is a small amount of gold bullion left, but it's just 1% of reserves. So this is pretty interesting, especially when you look at the chart of Ukraine gold holdings in recent years. You see that at the time, just a few years ago, there was about 25 tons of gold reserves in the country. And then Yanukovych went on a buying spree apparently, and managed to run that up to just over 40 tons. And now apparently it's down to zero that's being physically held in the country, or just about there. Very interesting that this has been admitted now, and it seems to confirm what we were speculating about earlier about this basically the price of liberation. What's your take on this story, and where the gold is really going to?
Well, who knows? I mean, the gold may already be sitting in Mr. Putin's vaults, you know, in satisfaction of some futures deals that he actually made a call upon. My take on this is the same as in Libya. You know, when the West came into Libya, the first thing that disappeared was Libya's gold. And I have a very strong sense that the only people capable of actually taking that would be the NATO forces. I mean, you and I couldn't walk down to the central bank and get it out of the country. So it had to be done at the point of a very big gun. And the only people wielding the guns big enough at that time were NATO. So, of course, that appeared in the paper that Libyan gold disappeared. And then, of course, there's no more articles in the manipulated Western media about where that has actually gone. It's we talk about the great train robbery as being a huge heist. But, you know, stealing an entire country's gold reserves is an even bigger heist that is not reported on. So then if we look at the Ukraine, I mean, it's just par for the course. I mean, the powers that come in, the IMF comes in, they say, all right, we'll give you a pile of paper money and a load of debt to subjugate your population for the next couple of generations. But by the way, we need to, as a sign of your goodwill, to have something tangible in return. And we can't actually, from one day to another, asset strip your country. So the best thing we can do is take your gold. So the gold just disappears overnight. The central bank is all very happy. The finance minister is happy. Mr. Yatsenyuk is delighted, probably. Mr. Poroshenko, all of them get a percentage in this wonderfully uncorrupt world that we live in. And, then there's they're very restive. But what the hell can they do? It's all gone, you know. as they say in Italian, chi ha dato ha dato, chi ha preso ha preso, which means, you know, who has given is given and who has taken is taken. I mean, it's just, it's as simple as that. And then, of course, when the gold ends up in the hands of these other people, if there's a shortage of physical gold that can no longer be satisfied out of the probably almost equally empty vaults in Fort Knox and the Federal Reserve in the U.S., then they've access to another pile of gold that they can keep the Ponzi scheme going for a little bit longer. And if on the other side of these trades there happens to be Mr. Putin who's trying to build up some physical gold inventories, you know, Ukraine's gold could now be sitting in the Russian central bank, for all I know.
Yes, it really could. I mean, it could be anywhere at this point. It's such an interesting little story. And of course, it's just a drop in the bucket on the bigger global scale. 42 tons is not a huge amount on the global scale. But for a country like Ukraine that is obviously suffering through the economic hardship that it is, that's a significant chunk of change. And, well, we'll have to see what takes place from here. But let's not hold our breath waiting for the New York Fed to confirm that they are holding or not holding that gold. Zero Hedge has had a request in since March. I believe the Gold Antitrust Action Committee has also had similar requests in. And surprisingly, the Federal Reserve is not returning their calls. I wonder why. All right, well, we've touched on a number of different gold-related stories, but gold is not the only commodity of import these days. In fact, it may not even be the most important in the current geopolitical climate, because if anybody's been keeping track of the oil market, they will know that there has been some huge moves taking place in recent months. And we've talked about this again on the Corbett Report a couple of times in recent months, talking about the secret Saudi U.S. deal to try to squeeze out some of the U.S. State Department's competitors by dropping the oil price. And, well, I mean, it certainly seems to be an effective strategy if you're taking a look at the Venezuelan bond market and what's happening there, the chaos and havoc that's happening in the potential default of Venezuela based on their plummeting oil price, oil revenues. And Russia also being, of course, similarly squeezed, as I just wrote about in my subscriber newsletter. And the latest coming from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard at The Telegraph, Bank of America sees $50 oil as OPEC dies, talking about how the Bank of America is now projecting that prices are going to slump down as far as $50 a barrel and in the coming months. And that is going to have a significant effect on the global oil markets, obviously, on the market for the shale gas that's coming out of the United States and its viability. And it's going to have geopolitical ramifications as well, of course. David Smith, your take on what's going on right now with oil?
Well, that's a huge question. But it's what's good for one is bad for the other, I think, is about all you can say. I mean, if you look at it, there is a general slowing down of the world economy. And, you know, all of the basics which are required, you know, for production or whatever else it is, you know, construction and so on, the actual amounts of you know, goods required are dropping. So if you look at the price of iron, you look at the price of oil, you know, you take a country like China that's slowing down because basically the demand from the rest of the world is reducing, and then perhaps they've decided to build one less phantom city next year than they've done in the past, you know. So there are reasons for the market price to be dropping. There's also a strong reason for manipulation of the price to make life as difficult for Russia as they possibly can. But Russia is not the most vulnerable to these moves. If we take a few of the countries that are you know, severely hit, you take Venezuela, which, as you say, is tottering on the edge of complete economic collapse. And no doubt they'll be collateralizing the various hookers that are hanging around Caracas as IMF reserves, not IMF, as central bank reserves very shortly. And if they count the money in the GDP, then they may as well count it in the assets of the central bank. But if you look at, say, America, and you see the fracking, the business coming from that, that is very vulnerable to price reductions. And the other thing that is very amusing about it is that apart from adding part-time jobs to the economy in terms of waiters and lowly paid part-time employees, the only significant industrial place where there have been large number of people employed has been in shale oil extraction and so on. So if a million jobs disappear there, that's going to be a little bit embarrassing. And of course, there are a lot of a lot of people have been investing in these, you know, the latest Ponzi scheme produced by Wall Street, which is going to collapse very short term if the prices don't go back up again. Then, you know, you've got the bigger players like Saudi who can and sit it out for a long, long time, deal with lower prices. And if Russia was a target, well, you know, they're hit in a medium way. You know, they have their currency has collapsed about 35%. The price of oil has gone way down. But at the end of the day, as their exports are mainly priced in dollars, you know, they're getting, you know, when they convert those dollars back to rubles, it looks pretty good. And it also is a collapsing exchange rate. I mean, basically, what Japan is trying and failing to do, Russia is having done to them and being quite successful. So, you know, it's going to cut domestic excess spending on stupid things produced by the West, like Louis Vuitton handbags and Ferraris and all the rest of it, because there'll be maybe fewer people who can have it. But it doesn't. The fact that the price drops doesn't affect the industrial capability or the size of the oil and gas reserves in Russia. So I don't see it as the massive catastrophe that the West would love to portray it to be.
Having said that, there is a secondary effect that could squeeze Russia in a different way, and that's on its ability to find an export market in Europe. And basically, the argument here is that the changes in the oil price is going to also drive down the price of liquefied natural gas, making it cheaper and easier for Europe to supply its gas from LNG rather than from the pipelines from Russia. So there may be a squeeze in that regard. And if that's the case, we may see Europe with a plentiful supply of gas in the coming years as LNG enjoys something of a boom.
I'm not so sure. I mean, we're dealing with a relatively immediate situation, and there is no real alternative supply for Western Europe. There's no serious alternative to Russia as a source of supply, particularly of gas, because that's their main business. But, you know, even if there were alternative supplies, and you say you're talking about stuff coming, exports from America, the very companies that are theoretically meant to be exporting may well have gone bankrupt in the next 6 months anyway. And then, of course, you have to build LNG terminals to be able to export the stuff. And in the US, I think the only one that they have that's of any scale and operational is in Alaska, which is really particularly handy for dropping the stuff off in the afternoon to Western Europe. There's nothing on the eastern seaboard. So the capital expenditure and the time delays before America could be a serious supplier and exporter of gas would be several years at very best, assuming that they continue to be able to have a source of economically reasonably priced petroleum product, you know?
Well, then just finally picking up on another point that you made earlier, the fact that is that the recovery that we've been touted for the last 5 years, of course, has been a lot of smoke and mirrors that has been propped up by the funny money liquidity insanity from the QE from the Federal Reserve. And it's interesting now that we see that unwinding is when we see the commodity prices falling, not just oil, but a lot of other commodities price falling right now. Is this a sign of a deflationary depression cycle that we're heading into?
I think the answer is clearly yes. I mean, we've been in the fact that there's been so much money pumped into the system without it actually creating any significant inflation. Japan's been the best example of it. Is a clear indication that there's a massive deflationary undertow in the system. Now, unfortunately, you know, when you try and pump up balance sheet assets or the stock market or net worth of people on paper, it produces inflation for the poorer people who don't have any net worth at all. So you're using the central banks to destroy the interests of the normal citizen, same way Switzerland is doing at the moment. But no, I don't.
And can you just take a moment to explain, because for the last few years, of course, we've heard a lot of pundits talking about inflation and potential hyperinflation from all this money going around. And we've had this idea of wheelbarrows full of money, and you better pay for your meal at the beginning because it'll be cost twice as much by the end, the time you're finished eating your meal, and that type of hyperinflationary scenario. So what does a deflationary scenario look like for the average person? How does it hurt them?
Well, deflationary situation looks very good for the average person, which is exactly why the elites don't want to have it. Because deflation means your rent goes down. Deflation means cost of food goes down. Cost of fuel goes down. Look at the panic at the moment when you see the price of petroleum, oil dropping like a stone. Who's panicking about that? You know, it's not you and me taking the kids to school in the morning who are panicking about it. It's all the oil companies thinking about the share price, you know, their next huge development project. And by increased stock prices into the pension plans of the rich. So, I mean, everything to do with deflation is good for the very ordinary guy in the street, or increasingly these days, unfortunately, on the street. And that is why it is being fought against by all means. And of course, everybody, you know, from the politicians down say, oh my goodness, deflation is terrible. But is it? Is it?
Well, it's bad for those who are in debt, but good in every other way, and good for those who have saved for the long term. But again, we'll have to see how this actually plays out. And I think there are a lot of different factors to take into account. And of course, this does raise the specter of the geopolitical conflicts that will no doubt take place if this really does reach the point at which we see entire economies failing, as I think Venezuela might be one of the first up on the chopping block next year when they have several billion dollars of debt coming due in September, October. So we'll have to see how they're able to cope with that. But in the meantime, of course, we'll be here with our heads up, with our periscope pointed at the horizon, looking for potential dangers. And of course, that is the raison d'etre of Geneva Business Insider. So why don't you tell people a little bit about what you do?
Well, I'm basically a financial advisor. I don't give investment advice, but I give general financial advice. You can see more about me if you go to my blog. And if there's anything that I've said of interest that you want to discuss, by all means, send me a mail. And if there's anything I can do for you professionally, then obviously get in touch as well. Thank you.
All right, excellent. Well, I can't believe it, but it looks like the hotel Wi-Fi connection is pretty much 99% good. So amazing technology at our disposal to get this information out to the masses. It's an amazing age to live in, and I appreciate each and every one of our conversations, David. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Philip. It's a pleasure as always, James. Thank you.